If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Jose Candelario, and today I am speaking with Congressman Joe Courtney from the 2nd District. Good afternoon, Mr. Courtney.
Good afternoon, Jose. Pleasure to be with you.
Okay, sir. So tell me a little bit about your first campaign. What office did you run for, and how was that experience? And what did you learn from that that still stands true today?
Sure. So, I was a state representative for 4 terms up in Vernon, Connecticut, which is sort of north central Connecticut. But in terms of Congress, my first run for Congress, I actually lost. It was in the year 2002, and the seat, which had been Democrat for decades, had flipped Republican in the year 2000. Congressman Rob Simmons defeated Democratic incumbent Sam Gaydenson at the time. It was a very close race. And anyway, I ran in 2002. It was a very contested primary. Settled very late in the calendar there. We thought we were going to catch him at the end, but, came up short by about 10,000 votes. These races, it's about 200,000 plus people vote in these campaigns. It's actually closer to 300,000 now in 2022. But anyway, that experience of losing a campaign was, in retrospect, probably the best thing that could have ever happened to me. Because it was obviously very disappointing when your name's on the ballot, and you lose. It's hard not to take it personally. Plus the fact that we made it really close at the end, kind of was a big sort of disappointment. And I did not run the next cycle. I'm married and have two sort of grade school age kids. And it was just too much, to sort of do it. These campaigns, particularly for Congress and the 2nd District, which is half of the state's geography, it's pretty much everything east of the Connecticut River. It's very taxing. And so ran again in 2006, learned some lessons from being defeated, spent a lot more time up at the University of Connecticut campus talking about issues like the high cost of college, student loans, et cetera, which are obviously still with us today. And we ended up winning by 83 votes out of 241,000 votes cast. It was we had to go through the whole recount process. It was 1/300th of a percentage point was the margin at the end of the day. And honestly, taking office after that experience and realizing, how you could just go through your mind about, moments where you were talking to people who, you could convince to, support you who are skeptical. You don't take the office for granted. I mean, you really realize that every vote does really count, and every person you represent, whether they voted for you or not, matters and counts. And that's a far different experience than a lot of people I serve with, who come from very gerrymandered seats where they're either very dark blue or very dark red, and honestly, they just really don't have to approach their constituents the same way. And I'm still at it, at this point. But again, that experience, is I think a healthy one, because no one should sort of view their seat as their property or it belongs to them, or you can take it for granted. You really have to do the job and be out there for the people you represent every day.
So now, there's a young lady out there that's interested in political office. Would you recommend it to them and testify to the amount of sacrifice you have to make sure that you're there for your constituents every day?
I mean, if a person has a burning passion to get, to make things better in their community or their district or their state. I mean, I highly recommend it. And, you know, it's an experience where, you know, campaigning can be rough. And, you know, particularly when it's close races, things can get even rougher, you know, in terms of, you know, some of the stuff that's on social media and television, all that stuff. But, you know, having the opportunity to, you know, do big things, you know, in terms of being part of, you know, major achievements in the Congress, whether it's, you know, the bill that we just passed to finally negotiate lower prices for medications for folks that took 60 years, you know, according to AARP, to get, you know, things like insulin costs down, and they're negotiating now a whole host of other prescription drug costs to a lower level, or the PACT Act to help veterans who were exposed to toxic exposure, whether it was in, you know, serving in the Middle East or in Vietnam, or the little things, you know, which is that you actually, you know, help people who are being unjustly treated, whether it's by the VA or Social Security or, you know, a whole variety of issues that are out there, you really make a difference. And that's, you know, not something that I think everybody can say necessarily about, you know, the kind of work that they do, you know, and it's not for the faint of heart. Like I said, and this Congress right now is also, you know, brutal in terms of just how divided it is. But, you know, I believe strongly in the fact that, you know, we have a system that is worth protecting and preserving and participating at the youngest ages, even pre-vote, you know, voting age, I think can really, is really important. And I love going to high schools. I love talking to you know, people who want to be interns in our office to get their, you know, perspective on things. And so I highly, highly recommend it.
Who were those influences early on that provided you with the ethics to go ahead and represent your people?
So, you know, I when I first got out of law school, I was a public defender, actually, in the criminal courts, which I think, as you know, that's sort of the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution, that everyone has a right to counsel. And, you know, you're representing people in pretty tough, you know, situations, and, you know, sometimes built crisis. And, you know, I've worked with some amazing folks who, you know, really, you know, focused on doing their duty, you know, to live up to the constitutional right to counsel. And, you know, you had your sometimes your victories where, you know, you actually got a verdict in favor of your client in front of a jury, or sometimes you had, you know, really tough situations where you lose or your client loses. And so, you know, that in terms of the kind of approach I take to casework, in terms of constituents, that's always, you know, I've carried that with me, you know, in terms of just, you know, trying to really do everything you can, you know, using, you know, the law and the facts, you know, which obviously guide the outcome of a lot of situations, but certainly to try and help people as much as possible. In terms of, you know, my sort of political, you know, examples or heroes, I mean, I, you know, grew up in the 60s. I was pretty young, but certainly remember, you know, the work of, you know, Kennedy and, you know, the Great Society under Johnson, Martin Luther King, you know, some of the, you know, really amazing public figures back in those days. And, you know, I still think their words ring true. Well, when I've been in Congress, you know, I have the opportunity to serve with John Lewis, who was, you know, one of Martin Luther King's lieutenants there, and who, you know, was one of the most, like, powerful individuals in terms of, you know, his, you know, deep, deep conviction that, you know, came through in his speeches and his work when he was there. But he was also really one of the most down-to-earth, humble people as well. I mean, he had no airs about him. He, you know, somebody was an international world figure, but, you know, was willing to talk to the newest member of Congress or staff person or, you know, people who work in the building there. So, you know, he really, honestly, it stands out to me as just sort of, you know, probably the greatest individual that I had a chance to sort of rub elbows with and be up close and watch him up close.
You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario here speaking with 2nd Congressional District Congressman Joe Courtney. How important is it to be open and to listen to other people and learn and gather information?
So it is critically important. I mean, we the structure of really our democracy, you know, which is obviously designed in the U.S. Constitution and, you know, state constitutions and local charters, you know, really is built around, you know, in terms of the legislative process, is built around, you know, structures that really succeed based on compromise. I mean, it's just, you know, there was a recognition, you know, when the Constitution was written, and it's been amended, obviously, a number of times since, but that, you know, that there's going to be diversity and divergent views, and, you know, that it's hard, you know, unanimous support is just really impossible in terms of, you know, all the challenges that having a society and a government succeed. So the ability to listen in terms of trying to understand people who disagree with you, trying to, you know, identify areas of common, you know, agreement and consensus, you know, again, just means that you have to, you know, do everything you can to try and understand the people that you're serving with. It's very difficult right now, to be perfectly honest with you, but still, you know, you sort of try to find, you know, common areas to work together on. So, and by the way, that exists not just between, you know, Democrats and Republicans. It also exists among, you know, Democrats and other Democrats, and same, you know, vice versa. So, so listening is really, you know, critically important. And, you know, when I got my law degree, you know, a lawyer who I respected greatly, you know, said, you know, a good lawyer knows when to stand up and speak up, you know, for their clients. A great lawyer knows when to keep your mouth shut and to listen. So I've, you know, tried to follow that principle.
What yeah. other things do you do to maintain your energy and to maintain that youthful spirit?
So the job, by the way, I mean, just sort of inherent in the job, you know, you're always, if you're, you know, going to do it correctly, then, you know, you really have to, you know, get out there and interact with folks in the district. And we, you know, really try to, it's a very diverse district in terms of, you know, the nature of it. I mean, it's the most rural part of the state of Connecticut, you know, the most number of farms. You know, it's also has the University of Connecticut, as you point out, the flagship university of the state. It has the largest military installation in New England with the Groton submarine base, and then the shipyard that's down there, Electric Boat, you know, which has now 23,000 workers between, you know, part of the operations are in Rhode Island, but the rest are the largest part of it are in Groton. So you're out there mixing it up and interacting with people, and yeah, you got to stay on your toes, and that keeps you young, you know, in my opinion, you know, because you got to be on your, you know, A game in terms of, you know, really trying to interact with folks that's there. So, you know, physically, I try to, you know, watch what I eat and be careful, you know, about trying to, you know, be sort of watching things like your vitals and all that, because, you know, the stress level can sometimes, you know, really catch up with people in this work. My wife is a pediatric nurse practitioner. You know, we spend as much time as we can, you know, when I'm home. And I have two kids, you know, one lives in New York City. My other is a daughter who's works at a daycare center, but also is a painter and artist. And so, you know, that all sort of helps and keeps you young as well. I'm a golfer. I, you know, confess to that, but never played with Trump, played with Obama. So, you know, and I'm a walker. I'm not somebody, you know, gets in a cart and drives around out there. I try to make it, like, you know, sort of good exercise. Used to be a runner, but those days sort of passed me by when I had to get a hip replacement, and it probably aggravated my hip. But anyway, it's, yeah. It's a challenge, but you do your best.
How important was it to you to bring the funding to an electric boat?
So as I mentioned earlier, it's you know, a huge shipyard, and when I took office, because the Navy had really, you know, stopped or you know, really scaled back its program for submarine construction, it was really on a downward spiral. I mean, if you go back into the 1980s and 1990s, you know, when you know, submarines were very in high demand, you know, the shipyard was close to 30,000 people. Back then, I mean, the shift change that, you know, if you were down there, it was just like an amazing sight of, you know, people when the factory whistle blew, you know, just, you know, stampeding out of the gates there. And same thing in the morning when you're there. So it had declined to roughly about 7,000 back in 2006. And, you know, at some point, if it had continued in that trend, the yard probably could have closed. And, you know, working with colleagues, you know, we really turned that around significantly. Obviously, if we're back up to 23,000 workers that are there, these are good jobs. In Connecticut, they're all union jobs. The metal trades, you know, the electricians, the shipwrights, the ship fitters, the sheet metal workers, the machinists, electricians, you know, again, they're all belong to unions, and they're good, you know, they have good labor contract. They just signed a new one, actually, end of last year. And, you know, the wage level benefits are something that you can actually support yourself and a family on. So, you know, bringing that back, and I sit on the Sea Power Subcommittee, which is the committee that has jurisdiction over the Navy and Marine Corps budgets. You know, the contracts that, you know, again, basically provide the funding for submarine construction, you know, come through our subcommittee there. So, you know, honestly, again, I feel very lucky in some ways that I am actually represent a district with a direct connection to the federal government via the Navy. It's so strong. I mean, the shipyard has one customer, and that's the Navy. So, and Congress is the one who authorizes and funds the Navy's budget. So it's there's a very straight line between the work from my office and the folks that are getting hired down there.
What is the effort that you're making to make sure that you're truly inclusive in your approach?
So you're absolutely right. I mean, if you go back to the 80s and 90s, and you know, I'm old enough to remember sort of what the workforce looked like back then, but you know, it was a you know, basically a white baby boomer era male workforce. I mean, it was just, you know, if you were standing there at the factory gates, you know, shaking hands, you know, at the shift change there, it really was almost 100% male and virtually, you know, entirely white and Caucasian. So, you know, there was definitely some folks who stood out, but it's predominantly that way. So today, you know, with the new hiring that's going on, women now represent about 17% of the workforce, which, again, we're talking about basically going from 0 to 16%. And if you look at the year-upon-year increases, you know, women are growing at the rate of about 15 to 20% year in and year out. So there's women welders, you know, that you see that are, you know, coming into work every day. There's, you know, as I said, people in the metal trades. There's a design workforce that does, you know, again, the planning and drawings. All of it, of course, is virtual now for submarine construction. And again, very high number of women in that profession that's there. And you know, they're still hiring like crazy. In terms of Hispanics, that actually is also you know, a really striking change that's happened. The percentage of Hispanics in the workforce is about 20% people of color, and the Hispanics are actually have a higher number of, you know, and within that cohort that's there. There's been a 41% increase in Hispanic workers. Black and Asian workers have also spiked up, you know, well above 25%. So, you know, if you're standing there at the factory gates, you know, at 6 o'clock o'clock in the morning, watching people to come to work. It is a totally different workforce that's going in there every day, and it's increasing with every year of hiring that's going on. You know, women welders, by the way, are actually in really high demand because I think attention to detail is something that some of that you talk to some of the old timers that are there, they're actually pretty impressed. You know, with how a job like that, which maybe intuitively wouldn't sound, you know, like a great fit, we just had a keeling for one of the new subs, the USS District of Columbia, and it was a 26-year-old Hispanic woman who had the privilege of doing the ship sponsor's initial on the deck plate. You know, that's what they do at the keel laying there, and that's a great honor for someone to be given that, you know, role at this you know, huge ceremony that goes on there. But she's really good. She earned it, and so it's very exciting to see that. You know, the way it's happening is that, you know, EB is using every possible approach to try and recruit people. Again, last year was the hiring was 5,300 people that they hired. Same target for 2024. So some of it is done, by advertising in terms of recruitment. Some of it is done by job fairs and outreach. And again, they're going outside of Groton in New London, Connecticut. I mean, they're going all over the place that's there. And they have a, you know, weekly job fair. It's called Walk-In Wednesdays, where any of your listeners, you know, between 12 and 4 at Electric Boat in Groton on East Point Road there, you can just walk in. You have no appointment necessary. You can bring a resume if you like. You should. I mean, I think that would help the process that's there. But again, it is, as I said, a completely wide open aperture for people to connect. And and they're going into the high schools now, even.
You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario here speaking with 2nd Congressional District Congressman Joe Courtney. So, yes, okay, so, you know, in your bigger cities, you have a lot of black and brown young men and women. What efforts are you making to make sure that they are trained and have some kind of skill set to go ahead and obtain these jobs?
So, I mean, Wyndham has a tech school, career and technical school, and I've visited there a number of times. They actually have employees, you know, engineers and, you know, foremen who come up and actually get right into the classroom. And they do, you know, try to make sure that people of color are part of that cohort that comes into the classroom because, you know, obviously I think it just creates a connection for students that's there. And this has been going on for a number of years. The school superintendents there have recognized that, you know, giving kids an opportunity to learn about this and hopefully connect to it is really just going to be life-changing in terms of, you know, having not just a job but a career. They're also reaching out now to comprehensive high schools, you know, non-trade schools. And, you know, in the old days, they used to call it shop class, mm-hmm. you know, when they would, yeah, provide. So you're seeing actually curriculum change happening in a number of schools. They call them career pathways now. They don't call it SHOP, but it's still the same principle, which is that, you know, they use federal Perkins grant money to bring in machine tools and, you know, really go through, you know, starting at the beginning with just the rudimentary sort of, instructions about how to, you know, learn about, you know, this type of skill. And then, you know, the if it goes well, then, I mean, they're ready for being hired the day they get their diploma. So last year, I know in the trade schools, EB, like, vacuumed up every kid they could possibly, you know, get their hands on who had gone through, you know, the metal trades programs at the trade schools. And I think it was about 300 hires was the number out of comprehensive high schools. We're talking non-trade schools. So, as I said, the schools are adjusting. They're really, you know, catching on that they need to, you know, create a curriculum that's really connected to the job market that's there. And EB, you know, I talk to the HR department all the time. They're very much serious about moving west, you know, into New Haven County, west and sort of north up to Harford County, and you know, they want to build these relationships, you know, with the high schools in those regions that are there. Because if you look at the planning that they're engaged in right now, this hiring pace is going to continue through the rest of this decade and into the early 2030s. So, you know, at some point you got to go where the people are, you know, in terms of, you know, trying to fill that demand. For older individuals who maybe, you know, are working after high school or college or whatever, you know, there are now job training programs that are very accelerated that, you know, basically give people enough of a semi-skilled status that they're ready to be hired. It's in Connecticut, or Eastern Connecticut, it's called the Manufacturing Pipeline Initiative. 10 weeks for a welder, 8 weeks for an outside machinist and electrician. It's like 5 or 6 weeks for a painter that's there. It's, again, it's free, and it's operated through the State of Connecticut Department of Labor in conjunction with what's called the Workforce Board. This is the group that came together to design the curriculum for these classes. Last year, they had 1,000 individuals who graduated from the pipeline. Again, they're ready to be hired, you know, the day they get their certification, you know, when they complete the course. And, you know, EB, again, just loves that program because it's short enough that it's fast enough that it helps satisfy the immediate demand, but it's long enough that people get so enough immersion in terms of what the work looks like so that there actually is higher retention for people who go through that program. I mean, some folks, they just hire who come in off the street and, you know, maybe had some work, you know, had some job experience that seemed like a pretty good fit. Sometimes those folks push out faster because it's like they get in there and say, like, I'm not sure this is really what I thought it was going to be or something like that, which is fine. You know, it's a free job market that's there. But so the pipeline program for, you know, older, you know, post-high school, post-college adults, the trade schools and high schools are, you know, now really catching on in terms of the programs that's there. And then there's just, as I said, just the regular recruitment that's going on through advertising and job fairs.
You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario here speaking with 2nd Congressional District Congressman Joe Courtney. So we're in our final minutes here in our conversation. Any words about the future in your seat that you would like to share with your constituents?
So, you know, like I said, I've been at this for a while, and I know I'm not going to do it forever, that's for sure. But I am still, you know, somebody who is an optimist and really feels that, we still have better days ahead. And I was just in Willimantic this morning with the Undersecretary of Agriculture for Rural Development, and we were with a community kitchen that is very focused in terms of, you know, healthy food, helping local farmers with their produce, but also, you know, it's a social justice and equity mission that this community kitchen is engaged in there. It's called CLIC, and they receive some funding from the Department of Agriculture. And, you know, Willimantic, you know, which really had a very, you know, in my opinion, unfair characterization of the community, I think it's really coming back really strong. And honestly, the Hispanic community is probably the biggest positive driving force in terms of just you going down Main Street and, you know, people who are small businesses that are investing their, you know, hard-earned money and time and effort. They're you know, really transforming Willimantic in a really good way. And that visit today, you know, kind of reinforced it. So that kind of gets you out of bed in the morning, you know, that you know, working with community groups, getting some seed money can, you know, benefit, you know, these old-time Yankee farmers, you know, that you know, get their goods processed and sold at a community kitchen, but also bring in, you know, the community. And the woman who prepared the food for us was like, I mean, she was like a magician, and the food was just absolutely out of this world. You know, of course, Latino menu that was there, it was awesome. So I feel very lucky, you know, to have this opportunity to represent such a great district.
This has been the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario, and we just had a great in-depth conversation with Congressman from the 2nd District, Joe Courtney. Thank you very much, Joe Courtney. And like always, thank you for your listen.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.